Hi, everyone. Welcome to 10 Parsha Points podcast. This is Rabbi Yisrael Isaacs, and we're ready to start Parshas Va'era. Parshas Va'era really begins in the middle of a story that happened at the end of Parsha Shmos, after Moshe had gone to Paro for the first time with Aaron to tell him that God said that he should let the Jewish people leave Egypt. And he, of course, said no. But not only that, he made the slavery and work that the Jews were doing more difficult. That led the people to complain to Moshe, and he came back to the Almighty saying, I've just made things worse. God responds that Moshe will see that in the end, Paro will send out the people and this plan will work. That brings us to the beginning of Parshas Va'era, where he continues to tell Moshe that he made many promises and commitments to the patriarchs, and he used the name Kael Shakai, which normally indicates God's power. In this case, it's the name used that indicates commitment or promises. But he says he never fulfilled those commitments to the forefathers. He made a covenant with them, but it has not yet come to realization. Now is the time that he will take the Jewish people out of Egypt and bring them to the land that he promised to the patriarchs. It's a time for fulfillment, and that is indicated by God's name, Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, the Shem Havaya, which indicates God's faithfulness to punish those that deserve punishment eventually and reward eventually those that deserve reward, and also the God that keeps his commitments and fulfills his promises. So he's now ready to move into that mode, and this is all part of that process. This is where we encounter what are called the four Lashonos of Geula, the four phrases or the four words that describe the redemption of the Jewish people from Egypt. To paraphrase, God says, Votsesi, I will take the Jewish people out of Egypt. Vitzalti, I will save them from their slavery. Vigoalti, I will redeem them with a outstretched arm and with great judgments. Vilakachti, and I will take them to me to be my nation. These four words are the basis for the rabbinic mitzvah of having four cups of wine on the Seder night. Each cup corresponds to one of these words. And what that shows us is that the four cups are intended as a commemoration, a symbol, and a celebration of our redemption. The Torah then reviews Moshe's concern that he would not be able to be expressive enough because of his verbal deficiencies to be the one that would deliver messages to Paro. God tells him that he will give him Aaron to be his assistant, and that's what they did. The Torah then interestingly introduces the background of Moshe and Aaron now that they have been established as leaders. And it does so by listing the names of Yaakov's grandchildren, meaning the children that were born to the 12 tribes. It starts with Reuven and Shimon and then gets to the third son, Levi, which is the one that the focus is on right now because his grandchildren are Moshe and Aaron. One of the verses in this genealogical passage mentions the two brothers as Aaron and Moshe. And if you look throughout the Torah, the order of their names, whenever they're mentioned together, is sometimes with Aaron first and sometimes with Moshe first. The question is there any significance to that order? We would think that Aaron might be listed first because he was the older of the two. But on the other hand, maybe Moshe should be listed first because he was the primary one chosen to do this mission. But whatever the rationale may be, it should be consistent, one would think. Rashi explains that the name order is switched to teach you the lesson that they're both equals. Moshe and Aaron are both equals. If one of them would be listed first and not the other, that would lead us to assume that the one listed first is superior to the one listed second. Therefore, the person listed first is inconsistent to show that neither of them is superior to the other. But that's actually very surprising. It's clear that God selected Moshe as the leader, which would seem to indicate his superiority. And as far as his ability as a prophet goes, the Torah says explicitly that there were no prophets greater than Moshe, and Aaron was also a prophet, and that includes Aaron. Moshe was a much greater prophet in a league all by himself. So in what way was Aaron equal to Moshe? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who I've mentioned many times, who lived from 1895 to 1986, who was a great rabbinic leader, halachic decisor, and Torah scholar. Rabbi Feinstein answers this question with a fundamental idea that is crucially important to describing Jewish life. He acknowledges that Moshe had greater potential and talents, and that's why he was burdened with more responsibility. Aaron was as great as Moshe, he suggests, not in terms of his potential or what he had accomplished or what he would accomplish, but in terms of his virtue. He was just as virtuous as Moshe. And virtue is defined by living up to one's own potential, whatever that may be. Although each of them had their own individual capabilities, both of them fully utilized whatever potential they had to the best of their ability. They both fulfilled their own personal life missions, and in that sense, they were equal. This is so important because it suggests that in the eyes of the Torah, our success is not measured by what our mission is, but by how fully each of us utilizes our unique abilities to complete that mission. To go a step further, in a broader sense, this is an acknowledgement of the fundamental uniqueness of every individual in the eyes of the Torah. This is an important point because the legal framework of the Torah, the halacha, which has to be observed by everybody in a uniform manner, generally speaking, is universalistic rather than individualistic. What emerges is a nuanced view of individualism. There are universal rules, laws, and guidelines, the halacha, that is a starting point for every individual, and each person's uniqueness is expressed both within that framework and with the spaces of their life, which are not dictated by those guidelines. And the truth is that this perspective of the balance between conforming and living as an individual is true about all creativity. I'd like to share with you a quote from the educator, scholar, and philosopher Mortimer J. Adler, who lived from 1902 to 2001. He writes, "Not everyone understands that being an artist consists in operating according to rules. People point to a highly original painter or sculptor and say, he isn't following rules. He's doing something entirely original, something that has never been done before, something for which there are no rules. But they fail to see what rules it is that the artist follows. There are no final, unbreakable rules, strictly speaking, for making a painting or sculpture. But there are rules for preparing canvas and mixing paints and applying them, and for molding clay or welding steel. Those rules the painter or sculptor must have followed, or else he could not have made the thing he has made. No matter how original his final production, no matter how little it seems to obey the quote, rules of art, as they have traditionally been understood, he must be skilled to produce it." That's page 53 of How to Read a Book. There's a similar idea expressed by Rabbi Soloveitchik when he was interviewed by the New York Times, and it was published on June 23rd, 1972. He was humbly denying that he was an authority in the usual sense of the word. He said the following, "I have many pupils, I have many disciples, but I never impose my views on anyone," he said. Judaism, he continued, "is a society of free and independent men and women bound by a single commitment and vision." The Torah's carefully inconsistent ordering of Moshe and Aaron's names teaches us that once we have established lives that relate appropriately to mankind and to God, once we live up to that single commitment and vision that it means to be Jewish, we must all be original artists as we paint the unique canvases of our lives. I'd like to share with you another thought based on the equivalence that Rashi explains that there was between Moshe and Aaron, and it's similar to the idea of a binary star system, which is a star system unlike our solar system, where we have one star, the sun, and the planets that are trapped in its orbit circle that one star. You can have a system where you have two stars that are orbiting around a common point, and the planets that are presumably trapped in their gravitational pull will orbit around both of those stars. This idea was exploited to very memorable effect by the original Star Wars movie with the two suns of the planet of Tatooine. Rav Soloveitchik says that the leadership of Moshe and Aaron was really a binary leadership model. Rashi is saying that they were both leaders. They were both leaders of the Jewish people simultaneously, dual leadership. And he says that this system seems to have prevailed during major periods of Jewish history, including till today, with the idea of a Rav or Rosh Yeshiva and a Rebbe. Moshe and Aaron were not just leaders of the Jewish people, they were also teachers. Moshe was, of course, the teacher par excellence of the Jewish people. We call him Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher, our master, rather than Moshe Malkeinu, Moshe our king, but he did exercise royal authority. Aaron, was a Kohen Gadol, the high priest, but he was a teacher as well. They were both teachers, but their temperaments differed. Moshe had his style of teaching, and Aaron had his own style of teaching. In Rav Soloveitchik's words, both of them enlightened minds, molded characters, and propagated the word of God. Both led their communities along righteous paths and made sacrifices for their welfare. Nevertheless, their methods, their approaches, and the media they employed were different. In terms of ultimate objectives, they were very close to each other, but their emphases varied. He goes on to explain that Moshe's style and approach was to engage the intellect. He analyzed, classified, clarified, and transmitted the halacha with precision. He teaches texts and conceptualized thinking, reconciling seeming contradictions, and formulating underlying principles. Aaron, however, exemplified what Rav Soloveitchik calls the saint teacher. He focused his attention on the invisible, intangible aspects of the Torah, the soul of the Torah, so to speak. And his objective is to communicate with the heart, to feel, not only to understand. As Rav Soloveitchik beautifully describes it, he teaches man both loyalty to halacha and the art of cleansing the heart of vulgarity, inhumanity, unworthy sentiments, uncouth emotions, and selfish desires. He teaches how a triumph is to be celebrated when the Almighty has granted success, and how to cope with sadness and grief. The saint teacher creates a society of intense personal piety and subliminal closeness to God. In the ecstatic and passionate love of God, it is the heart, not the mind, which predominates. Prayer, more than study, is the primary emphasis of the saint teacher. The teacher that appeals to the intellect and the teacher that appeals to the heart, each has its own scope of students that they appeal to. The scholar teacher appeals only to the few because not everyone is interested in the intricate details and abstract concepts of halacha or of science. He therefore appeals to a more limited group. The saint teacher or teacher that appeals to the heart generally has more of a mass appeal because everyone looks for meaning, wants to connect, and appreciates spirituality. And while in contemporary terms, these two types are exemplified by the Rav or Rosh Yeshiva on the one hand and the Hasidic Rebbe on the other hand, since everybody relates to the intellectual or the emotional on some level, some people relate to the intellectual more than the emotional, others relate to the emotional more than the intellectual, but everybody needs both. Every Jew needs to connect to both aspects of Judaism. It makes sense that the lines have blurred between these two roles, and the Rav / Rosh Yeshiva, the Moshe Rabbeinu, has some Aaron HaKohen in him as well, because every teacher should be able to appeal to and connect to the emotion of his students. And the Aaron HaKohen, the Chassidish Rebbe, has also developed into a role that also has an emphasis on scholarship and the teaching role. What we see from this Rashi that Moshe and Aaron are equated is that we need both types of leadership, a binary leadership that responds and speaks to both the mind and the heart in the service and worship of God. Continuing on with the summary of the Parsha, Aaron demonstrates that they were sent by God by throwing his staff to the ground, where it becomes a snake. Paro's Egyptians are able to mimic the trick, but then, as Rashi explains, Aaron's snake turns back into a stick, and when it's a stick, swallows the snakes that were created by the magicians. This raises the interesting question about the magic that is found here and elsewhere in the Torah. How were the magicians of Paro able to do this? The Rambam Maimonides holds that all magic mentioned in the Torah is nothing more than sleight of hand, and only the foolish people were fooled by it. Most classic commentaries in the Torah, however, assume that the Talmud relates to the magic in the Torah as authentic. Therefore, they explain that God installed magical powers in the framework of creation that people were able to tap into with the right spells or incantations or whatever it may require to access these powers. In chapter 7, verse 3, we see for the first time the idea that God says he will harden Pharaoh's heart. But I shall harden Pharaoh's heart, and I shall multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Pharaoh will not heed you, and I shall put my hand upon Egypt, and I shall take out my legions, my people, the children of Israel, from the land of Egypt with great judgments. The fundamental question about this idea of God hardening Pharaoh's heart is that we understand the idea of reward and punishment as long as there's free will. If I choose to do something bad and God punishes me, that makes sense. But if I only do something bad because God compelled me to do something bad, he hardened my heart, why should I be punished for that? And there are basically two ways to approach this that Ramban Nachmanides explains. Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman, was born in 1194 in Spain and died in 1270 in the land of Israel, was a Talmudist, halachist, biblical commentator, Kabbalist, and physician. And his biblical commentary is one of the most fundamental that we have. He gives two approaches to resolve this issue. The first one is that, as we know, the hardening of the heart only happened after a few of the 10 plagues had already been carried out. Only then his free will was removed and God hardened his heart. So whatever punishment they became liable to receive was based on before the hardening of the heart. And anything that happened after the hardening of the heart, they were not punished for. The second explanation says that really hardening of the heart doesn't mean that free choice is removed. What it actually means is that hardening the heart enables free choice to take place. Because if you think about it, the system that God set up the world with is that generally the world goes according to its normal rules, what we call nature. If God would constantly be performing open miracles, that would make it easier to believe in him, but we would lose our free choice. Therefore, he remains hidden and gives us that space in which we do have free choice. When the 10 plagues were taking place in Egypt, there was no free choice because it was so clear that God was intervening with the affairs of the world. So there's no way that Paro, in ordinary circumstances, would be able to continue to defy God when his existence was obvious. God therefore hardened his heart to enable him to ignore all these miraculous things that were going on and maintain his ability to make free choices and maintain his ability to make free choices in such an environment. I want to focus in on the second plague of Sephardea, frogs. Moshe tells Paro that if you refuse to send out, behold, I shall strike your entire boundary with frogs. The river shall swarm with frogs, and they shall ascend and come into your palace and your bedroom and your bed, and into the house of your servants and of your people, and into your ovens and into your kneading bowls, and into you and your people and all your servants will the frogs ascend. This is clearly a total infestation, an overwhelming infestation of frogs. Millions of frogs all over the place. Then God tells Moshe that he should tell Aaron, stretch out your hand with your staff over the rivers, over the canals, and over the reservoirs, and raise up the frogs over the land of Egypt. It's about to happen. Aaron stretched out his hand over the waters of Egypt, and what happened? The verse continues, Vata'al Hatsifardea, the frog ascended. Why is it in the singular now? It sounds like we're going to have millions of frogs all over the place. And then when it finally comes, it's one frog, hardly an epidemic. The simple explanation is that the term Sephardea can mean frog, or it could also mean a frog infestation. Rashi quotes a Midrashic interpretation, however, which has a very special message. He explains that it was only one frog. Rashi doesn't say this, but they say it was a giant frog. The Egyptians started hitting it, and thousands of frogs started pouring out of this frog in every direction, and the entire land became full of frogs. I saw something interesting in Hamodia magazine last month
in an interview with Rabbi Yitzchak Lichtenstein.
Rabbi Lichtenstein is a son of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein and a grandson of Rav Salvechik, and he became a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva Torah V'Das in Brooklyn in October of 2018. He was asked a question which related to the theme of Hanukkah, which is there a challenge of Greek wisdom, of Chachma Yevanis, that we're threatened by today? And if so, how do we address it? He responded by saying that today the Jewish people is not threatened by Greek wisdom, or anything intellectual for that matter. He says that in his opinion, today's challenge is our affluence. It's the gashmias, the physicality, that makes it difficult to connect to ruchnias, to spirituality. That's what is our greatest threat today. But that challenge, he said, cannot be addressed head on. Just like we see with the plague of frogs, that the more they hit the frog, if they directly attack the frog, it multiplied. A direct attack on our attachment to physicality and our dependency on creature comforts, if we attack them head on, it could exacerbate the problem. The best way to address the problem is to emphasize the beauty of spirituality, the pleasure of spirituality, of Torah study, true connection to Judaism, and personal and spiritual growth. That can eventually counteract the pull of gashmias, the pull of physicality. There's a question that has preoccupied the conversation in recent centuries in Jewish life, and that is, how does God look at Jews that have left the fold or are not acting Jewish? Does he give up on them, or does he remain hopeful that they're redeemable? In the fourth plague of Arov, the attack of wild animals, the Almighty says that he'll make a division between my people and your people, and the attack will not affect the Jews in the land of Goshen. What's interesting is that while the Jews were enslaved in Egypt, they were not very distinguishable from the Egyptians. Externally, we know they did maintain their dress. But the Medrash says that just as the Egyptians worshipped idols, the Jews worshipped idols. In terms of their behavior, which is most important, the distinction was not so obvious. As Rav Soloveitchik points out, the master of the universe was still able to discern this distinction, not only in this and other plagues, but in the entire idea that he redeemed the Jewish people. He perceived the holiness that was hidden deep inside the souls of these Jews, even though they were mired in idolatry and sin. And that's why he saved them. No matter how far we think we may be, no matter how unredeemable we may think we have become, God sees that spark hidden deep under the layers and is waiting for us to pick ourselves back up and start again. This parsha features the first 7 of the 10 plagues: Dam, Sephardea, Kinim, blood, frogs, lice, then Arov, Dever, and Shchin, the wild animals, pestilence, the plague, and boils, and finally Barad, hail. In next week's Parsha, Parsha's Bow, we find the last 3 Makos, the last 3 plagues: Arba, locusts; Choshech, darkness; and Makas Bechoros, the death of the firstborn.
I'd like to share with you some general concepts about the structure and patterns of the 10 plagues.
The first point is that the first 9 plagues can be divided into groups of 3 that correspond to each other. The pattern is that for the first 2 of the set of 3, Moshe would warn Paro that the plague is about to happen. However, the 3rd would come without any warning. So for the first 2, Dam and Sephardea, blood and frogs, Moshe warned Paro before bringing the plagues. Whereas in the 3rd, Kinim, lice, he did not provide a warning. He then warned Paro about Arov, the wild animals, and that plague came. Then he warned him about Dever, pestilence, the animal epidemic, and then that plague came. But the plague that followed those 2 of Shchin, boils, he did not give any warning for. And then finally, the 3rd set, he gave a warning about hail and Barad and Arba, locusts, but he did not warn about the 3rd of that set, meaning Choshech, darkness. Ramban, Nachmanides, we mentioned before, explains that warnings were only given for a plague that was likely to be fatal for people. But lice, boils, and darkness caused a lot of human suffering, but there was no risk of death. There's another pattern within this one. This is pointed out by Yitzchak ben Yehuda Abarbanel, commonly known as Abarbanel, who was a Portuguese Jewish statesman, philosopher, Bible commentator, and financier who lived in the 15th century from 1437 to 1508. He says that the warnings that were given for the first 2 plagues in each set of 3 also followed the following pattern. The first of the 2 warnings, God tells Moshe to go meet Paro early in the morning at the Nile. Rashi explains that Paro portrayed himself as a divine ruler, and divine rulers don't have to relieve themselves. So he would secretly go to relieve himself early in the morning. This was part of Moshe's defiance to specifically meet him at that time when he's most vulnerable. The second warning of each of these 3 sets, it doesn't have anything about going down to the river. God just tells Moshe to go speak to Paro. That constituted a more public warning that not only Paro would know about, but anyone who was present at the time when Moshe came, because he would be meeting Paro in his regular chambers or wherever Paro would be during the day. The final plague of Makas Bechoros, the plague of the firstborn, which is a 10th, that was also a public warning. Another way to categorize, or another pattern in the Makos, in the plagues, is that they can be classified into 4 categories according to who activated them or carried them out. The first 3 consecutive, Dam, Sephardea, Kinim, blood, frog, and lice, they were carried out or activated by Aaron. 3 of the later consecutive Makos of Barad, Arba, and Choshech, that's number 7, 8, and 9, hail, locusts, and darkness, they were activated by Moshe. 3 plagues that were not consecutive, Arov, Dever, and Makas Bechoros, wild animals, pestilence, and death of the firstborn, they were activated directly by God. And finally, 1 of the plagues, Shchin, boils, was activated by both Moshe and Aaron together. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful, fantastic Shabbos.